Alaska's House race. They have a ranked choice voting system. And in that House race, only about half the people who voted for the so-called traditional Republican in that race made Sarah Palin their second choice. Palin was backed by former President Trump. Others went either Democrat or no candidate at all. So how might that foreshadow other House races?
Well, most places don't have ranked choice voting, so we won't run into that issue. I think Sarah Palin had a unique problem. She's Sarah Palin. She left Alaska. She resigned from the governorship. And I don't think she had much to offer the people of Alaska. So I'm not reading too much into that one because of Palin and the ranked choice system. My main message to Republican candidates, if you're worried about Sarah Palin, is be true to your state and offer the general election voters something that everybody can grab onto and not just a narrow message that seems to be self-interested.
So, Dan, on Scott's point, isn't there a risk that President Biden is taking when he warns that there's a threat to democracy, while at the same time, the Democratic Party is spending money to boost the profiles of Trump-endorsed candidates in primaries?
Well, I agree that I think our local candidates need to run localized races, pardon me, that really allow those local campaigns to draw clear contrasts in their state. And I think what the president was doing is really establishing more of a meta-narrative that sort of sits in the backdrop and helps frame the national choice in this election and really allow the local voters and campaigns to have to make their own choice and run their own campaigns. I think it's smart.
May I respond to that for just a moment?
Go ahead, Scott.
I think Joe Biden's message was clear, and I actually think it's important that our democracy is under assault from what he said was MAGA ideology. And then he tried to separate certain kinds of Republicans from others, saying there are some I can work with and some that I can't. So then you go into a race like the New Hampshire Senate race or the Maryland governor's race or Pennsylvania or Colorado or Illinois or on and on and on, and you have the Democrat Party spending money to boost the people that Biden says are dangerous and to suppress the people like Peter Meyer in Michigan that he says he can work with. So it's the most cynical and the most hypocritical for the president, in my opinion, to tell the American people how dangerous something is. I mean, look, the Democrat Party is spending more money on these MAGA candidates than Donald Trump is. So to me, it's cynical and hypocritical, and it does undercut the president's core message. And if you want it to be a referendum on that, then your party has to follow along what the president has to say, and they're not doing it.
And Dan, isn't it asking for voters, a little too much for voters, to try and parse out who exactly the Democratic Party would like for them to support in terms of Republican candidates?
No, and I think, all politics are local. We've heard that for quite some time now, and it's a standard bearer in American politics. And you know, I think in many ways the contrasts that voters will face in November, you know, are in some ways, you know, previewed in these primaries. And I think putting Democrats in a place where we ultimately have the clearest contrast going into November is smart strategy.
Scott, there have been a few Trump-endorsed candidates who've won GOP primaries after repeating the former president's false claims about the 2020 election. Doesn't Biden have at least a valid point then about democracy being in danger?
Look, I think the election denialism is a dead end for the Republican Party. It's not what our party should be about. It's not what the clear winning message should be this November, and it's not going to serve the party well in 2024. Right now, Republicans should choose people who are focused on inflation, the economy, the future of our country, and so on and so forth. But I'm just going to return to my core point. If you believe that and you're a Republican, you should vote that way. And if you're a Democrat president named Joe Biden, you should tell your party, to stop spending money on the people who are trying to spread this election denialism throughout our system.
Scott, let me squeeze one more for Dan. Should Biden focus on the economy instead of what he's doing?
Well, I think the president has the ability to focus on multiple issues, and we're at an inflection point in our country.
Dan Senna and Scott Jennings, political consultants from opposite sides of the aisle. Dan, Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The GOP knows that if that party is going to win elections this year and in the future, they need more people to vote for them who are not white. With that top of mind, Republicans are opening so-called outreach centers in pivotal states, including Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Texas. Stephen Fowler with Georgia Public Broadcasting has more on the viability of the strategy.
In the heart of Georgia's most diverse county, just north of Atlanta, Democrats are now the dominant force in local politics, fueled by rapid population growth and increasing diversity. But earlier this summer, Republicans gathered to stake their own claim in the community.
My name is Ray Martinez. I'm a candidate for Georgia House District 111. I'm honored to be here today with such an esteemed group of people.
Martinez and dozens of other people packed into a strip mall in Gwinnett County for a grand opening.
I'm just as honored to be here today to open up the Republican National Committee Hispanic Community Center here in Viva Postal.
It's one of more than three dozen centers now open that reflect the diversity of the communities around them, from heavily Jewish Boca Raton, Florida, to a Native American community in North Carolina, to a majority black neighborhood in Northwest Philadelphia, a city where Donald Trump improved on his margins from 2016 to 2020. RNC Chairwoman Ronna McDaniel told the crowd at Georgia's newest outreach center that her party was committed to putting in the work.
This is not us saying we expect your vote, you owe us your vote. This is us saying we want to earn your vote. We want to learn how we can better represent your community, how we can be here long term.
The RNC Hispanic Center is one of three in Georgia, joining an Asian Pacific American location in another pocket of Gwinnett County and a Black American center just south of Atlanta. Paris Denard, a former national spokesman for the RNC who helped with minority outreach, says these spaces are not a new development, but rather continued investments that reflect the party's commitment in meeting voters where they are.
Politics is about establishing a connection with the voters. The more the voters are connected to you, be it a political party or a campaign or a candidate, the more likely they are to support you, to vote for you, and also to advocate for you amongst their friends and family members.
Someone who knows that well is John King, Georgia's insurance commissioner, a Republican, and the first Latino statewide officer in the state's history.
It's incredibly important because we know not only are we creating a bridge for the Latino voice to be heard at the highest levels of our state, but also for established communities.
King says conservative policies are resonating with more non-white voters, especially with the current state of the national economy. And he says these centers, staffed by local people and focused on programming and events, don't come across as pandering.
We're having a permanent presence and having a permanent conversation in Spanish, in English, about the values that the Republican Party bring, which are very much in line to the values that generally you hear from Hispanics.
But some Democrats say they don't think voters will buy it, like Nabila Islam. She's a Georgia State Senate candidate of Bangladeshi descent. Her district includes two of the RNC outreach centers.
They can continue to waste money in our communities trying to reach out to us, but we understand and we know that they're not here to help us, and they're just trying to use us in order to expand their power, and we're not going to let that happen.
That said, Democrats have also been accused of not investing consistently in voters of color, who the party often depends on.
We must invest in our communities by doing ethnic media outreach, by reaching out to black voters, Latino voters, and AAPI voters, and meeting them where they are. And so you have to always compete in order to win, and we can't take anyone for granted.
In this fall's elections, voters of color will still likely overwhelmingly vote for Democrats, but with a closely divided Congress, even a small shift in preference could make the difference in who wins and who loses. And once all the votes are counted, you can count on these RNC community centers to keep their lights on and doors open with an eye towards 2024 and beyond. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Fowler in Suwanee, Georgia.
This is NPR News.
Thanks for tuning in for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 19 past 8. Chile has voted a resounding no to a proposed constitution that would have put a focus on social issues and gender parity, enshrine rights for the indigenous population, and address climate change. We'll hear about that in 15 minutes.
All right, I'm just going to roll the tape here. Let's hit it.
It's weird having chickens stare at you, but if you get used to it, it's not much different.
I'm Kai Rizdal, and I say I would not ever get used to chickens staring at me, but some people do, I guess. Farm vacations next time on Marketplace.
Listen for Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from Bagels Forever, available fresh daily at the store in Madison and the frozen food case in grocery stores throughout the state. Bagels and bagel chips can be shipped anywhere in the U.S. at bagelsforever.com.
24/7 Jazz HD2 is available on your smartphone. For jazz, big band, and blues, go to the App Store and download the free WGTD app. HD2 is still available on your desktop at WGTD.org and in the Kenosha Racine area on your HD radio.
Some patchy morning fog and then a mix of sun and clouds in the south today. Sunny skies for the rest of the state, and we'll have highs from the upper 60s to mid-70s. On Tuesday, partly sunny in the south and mostly sunny elsewhere in the region, highs in the mid to upper 70s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from OCLC through WorldCat.org, committed to helping users conduct research or find the latest bestseller by accessing libraries around the world. Learn more at WorldCat.org. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for businesses of any size that comes with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and mobility features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. More at OOMA.com. And from CrowdStrike. Their cloud-native platform is designed to protect businesses from cyber attacks, ransomware, and data theft at home, at the office, and everywhere in between. More at CrowdStrike.com/NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Rachel Martin. A disease once thought to be eradicated is showing up again in some U.S. communities. We're talking about polio. And NPR's Ari Daniel brings us the story of one woman's struggle.
Minda Dentler got the text message from a friend of hers. Someone in Rockland County, New York, had gotten polio and was now paralyzed.
I was like in disbelief to see it in the United States. We have all these resources, and then to hear that somebody didn't get part of the regular childhood vaccines and that person could get polio, it was shocking to me.
That's because polio is personal for Dentler. She was born in India, and when she was just 6 months old, she contracted the disease. She missed the wave of universal immunization in the country by several years. The result: Dentler became paralyzed in both her legs. She can still feel everything. She just can't tell her legs to move.
My mother realized she couldn't take care of me, so she dropped me off at an orphanage.
When she was 3 and a half, a couple in the U.S. adopted her.
My body was sort of stuck in this, like, seated position. So I spent the first few years in America just going through a number of surgeries to basically straighten me out.
She learned to handle a wheelchair and to walk by using the crutches, her legs immobile beneath her.
I didn't want to take the disabled bus to school. Like, I wanted to be able to take the bus with my sister, and so I had to learn how to go up the stairs.
Her family was athletic, so Dentler often watched from the sidelines, wanting to compete herself.
But I couldn't.
When she was in her late 20s and living in New York City, a friend introduced her to a running club for athletes with disabilities. It's where she learned how to use her upper body to propel a three-wheeled low-to-the-ground bike, something called hand cycling, and where she met a friend in a wheelchair who completed a triathlon.
I remember watching him at the finish line thinking, that's what I want to do next year. Actually, I signed up for the race without knowing how to swim or run.
Within 7 months, she learned to swim and to compete using a racing wheelchair. When she finished her first race, she was motivated to go farther. She soon took up half Ironman triathlons, 70 miles of swimming, biking, and running. And she kept meeting people with extraordinary athletic ambitions. They inspired her to do what they were doing, one of the most demanding physical events in the world, the Ironman.
At the time, no female wheelchair athlete had ever made the time cutoffs to finish that race.
On her first try in Hawaii, she missed the cutoff, but a year later, she made it and became the first female wheelchair athlete to complete the grueling race. 140 miles in water and on land, propelled entirely by her arms and upper body.
I think it's important to stay physically active.
Dentler wins a medal for understatement, too. Since then, she's done three other Ironmans. Now, she's also in the midst of another marathon. She's a mom. Her daughter Maya is 7 years old and well aware of her mother's challenges and accomplishments. In fact, not long ago, she brought her into school for show and tell.
She said, "Who wouldn't want a mom like that?" The kids asked me a ton of questions, and it was actually pretty fun to answer them. And the kids' eyes would get really big when they heard that I could do all of these things.
The kinds of things Dentler had accomplished in spite of the virus. The virus that, as much as it's shaped her and as proud as she is of her achievements, she'd never wish upon Maya.
I remember vividly when she was 3 months old getting her first polio vaccine, I just remember crying because I realized, like, wow, she is not gonna face the debilitating effects of having polio like I have, just because she got access to a vaccine and I chose to get her immunized.
A similar choice sits before us all, Dentler argues. When she considers the current polio outbreak in New York, for her, it boils down to a single word: immunization.
I wish all people who may be on the fence about vaccination could really meet me. I'm a reminder to families that they should vaccinate their children.
Dentler is hopeful that polio will be eradicated everywhere in her lifetime, a dream that's been just out of reach for decades. But if we let our foot off the gas now, she says, the beast will just come roaring back. Ari Daniel, NPR News.
Summer street parties are winding down. Back-to-school festivals are taking their place with bouncy houses and free backpacks.
For one little girl in Washington, D.C., chalk is the main attraction.
I'm just drawing a duck.
Penelope was drawing a duck for Chalk Walk. It was organized by a group that offers an outlet for self-expression.
The group Positive Chalk grew out of the justice movements that followed the 2020 murder of George Floyd. It was a time when many parents might have been hesitant to take their young ones to protest marches and rallies, so Val Suarez brought chalk for the children in her community.
While they weren't able to go down to Black Lives Matter Plaza and protest with most of the community, they were able to get their voices heard through chalking.
The power of chalk caught on, and Chelsea Ritter Sorenen then founded an all-women's chalking initiative. She called it Chalk Riot.
Chalk is one of the most accessible public art forms because it is affordable. You can even use household items like barbecue charcoal or brick chunks.
And it's not just about getting the kids outside.
Yeah, Nehemiah Dixon is with the Phillips Collection in D.C., which supports both groups. He says the impact is deep and wide.
Art is about wellness, and I think in a lot of ways, art is a demonstration of resilience. It's like the closest thing to joy. And, you know, they always say, like, laughter is the best medicine. Well, so is joy.
Chalk Riot's Ritter Sorenen agrees.
When we create on paper or in coloring books or on designated spaces on walls, there's a finite limit to where and how you can create. Mm-hmm. But when we create on the sidewalk, I hope people see that they can just sprawl with color and take up space in an inspiring and empowering way.
This is NPR News.
The first black child to integrate an all-white elementary school in Louisiana wants to share her experience with a new generation of kids.
It touches on something that I truly want them to understand. Racism just does not make any sense.
I'm Elsa Chang, activist Ruby Bridges on transforming her story into a children's book this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered starting at 4 on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
Thanks for listening to Morning Edition on WPR. The latest news is next, including a look at the challenges faced by migrating birds in Wisconsin. Details of that story and all the latest state news after an update from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The U.S. Coast Guard says 9 people are still missing in Washington state following the crash of a float plane in Puget Sound. Casey Martin with member station KUOW says one body has been recovered from the water.
The plane left a popular seaport town Sunday afternoon and crashed near Whidbey Island, northwest of Seattle. Multiple emergency departments are continuing to search for 8 adults and 1 child.
Witnesses on Whidbey Island say the single-engine plane did a nosedive into the water. Police in Canada say they're looking for 2 suspects driving an SUV who are believed responsible for a deadly knife attack in rural Saskatchewan. At least 10 people were killed, 15 others wounded. Authorities say they believe some of the victims were targeted. They're not commenting on a possible motive. Britain's next prime minister will be Liz Truss. The UK's foreign minister has been elected as the new leader of Britain's Conservative Party, putting her in position to be named the next prime minister. That's expected to be made official tomorrow by Queen Elizabeth. Truss spoke after today's vote.
It's been a hard-fought campaign. I think we have shown the depth and breadth of talent in our Conservative Party.
Truss will succeed Boris Johnson. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. President Joe Biden visits Milwaukee today. Fox 6 Milwaukee reports Biden will deliver a speech at Meyer Festival Park. A statement from the White House late Sunday said the president will arrive at Milwaukee Mitchell International Airport this morning. He will deliver remarks, quote, celebrating Labor Day and the dignity of American workers. The White House said Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh will also attend. In Racine Sunday, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers said he was looking forward to introducing the president during his visit to Labor Fest. In the next few months, hordes of birds will cloak Wisconsin's skies each night as they head south for the winter. But as they fly over the state's cities and towns, these birds face a surprising threat: windows. Leah Treidler reports.
According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, glass on buildings kills an estimated 600 million birds each year, second only to cats. Chuck Hagner is the director of Bird City, Wisconsin. The organization recognizes municipalities for becoming more bird-friendly.
Birds, you know, evolved over the millennia to in essentially a buildingless environment, and they're a little bit different than we are in the way that they perceive glass.
He says birds don't understand that glass is a barrier, so they often collide with it. And since they're drawn to light, lit-up windows are especially hazardous. Hagner says people can help birds avoid collisions by turning lights off at night or putting lines or dots on windows so they can see that it's a barrier. Leah Treidler, Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Wisconsin State Journal reports that Madison and UW-Madison police on Thursday issued 137 underage drinking and fake ID citations at a single State Street bar. This was during the week when UW-Madison students were moving into dorms or returning to other campus housing. Police refused to name the establishment, but a person with knowledge of the investigation who declined to be identified because the investigation is ongoing identified it as City Bar. Madison police said in a statement Friday the operation was aimed at, quote, proactive enforcement of liquor laws in the downtown area. Police spokesperson Hunter Lisco said that a number of local bars were visited. He said that at the bar in question, officers located and cited 137 individuals for underage alcohol consumption and false identifications violations.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Business. From small business to big enterprise and everything in between, Amazon Business works to help simplify the supplies buying process. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system, designed to be taken every day. More at metamucil.com. And from the Lemelson Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Rachel Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. In Chile, a special assembly has spent the past 2 years writing a new constitution, and it was supposed to replace the current one that dates back to the country's military dictatorship. But yesterday, voters soundly rejected the new constitution in a referendum and then celebrated in the streets of Santiago. NPR's John Otis is just back from a reporting trip to Chile, and he joins us now. Good morning, John.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
So people clearly excited. Tell us what this rejection means.
Well, the rejection means a huge blow for Chile's President Gabriel Boric. He was a really big supporter of this new constitution, but nearly 62% of Chileans voted against it, compared to just 38% in favor. In fact, the outcome became so clear so quickly that the campaign for approval conceded defeat less than 2 hours after the polls closed.
Wow. I mean, they clearly didn't have the right political temperature on how this was going to go over with voters. Why was it so controversial, this new constitution?
You know, some have called it the world's most progressive constitution. For example, it would have vastly expanded rights for indigenous groups and created more protections for the environment. It would have made mandated universal health care, as well as the right to decent housing, education, and pensions. And it calls for gender parity in government and legalized abortion. But Chile is actually quite a conservative place. Married couples couldn't even get divorced in Chile until 2004. Some of this new constitution might have hurt the economy because, for example, stricter environmental rules might have put the brakes on the copper and lithium mining industries. It would have meant higher taxes to pay for a lot of these new government benefits included in the constitution. There was also a disinformation campaign that spread lies about it. And finally, you know, the best constitutions are usually short and to the point, but this one was really long. It had 388 articles, and it was just ended up being too much for voters to digest.
Yeah. So if you could just step back for a moment, explain what was behind this movement to draft a new constitution in the first place.
Well, there were two reasons. First, anti-government protests back in 2019 nearly brought down Chile's government to calm the waters and to address protesters' concerns about poverty and inequality. A special assembly began writing a new constitution. The other reason is that the current one was written back in 1980. That's when dictator Augusto Pinochet ruled Chile. Democracy was restored in 1990. And when most countries go through such momentous political changes, they write new rules of the game, new governing guidelines. But Chile never really got around to that until now.
So, I mean, what happens? Is the effort to change the constitution dead at this point?
It's not dead. President Boric went on Chilean TV last night and claimed that the effort to forge a new constitution isn't over. Let's take a listen.
Es que me comprometo a poner todo de mi parte para construir en conjunto con el Congreso.
So Boric is saying here that he plans to meet with Congress and civil society in the coming days to try to start this process all over again. This was expected because in spite of last night's rejection, polls show that Chileans don't like their Pinochet-era constitution either. But Boric has said whoever drafts the next version of the constitution, they're going to have to come up with something that unites Chileans rather than divides them like this one did.
John Otis, reporting for NPR. Thanks, John.
Thanks a lot for having me.
After Jackson, Mississippi's water system failed last week, drive-through sites for free bottled water were set up across the city. But what about the people who cannot drive? Stephen Basaja of the Gulf States Newsroom reports that the city is relying on nonprofits to get the water out.
People in Jackson haven't just been waiting a week for clean water. For many, it's been over a month.
Keep in mind, the city of Jackson has been on their boil water notice since July 29.
LaKenya Moore is the chief financial officer for Mississippi Industries for the Blind, which employs people who are blind or visually impaired in Jackson.
We've been working on this a month now to get water actually either delivered or delivered to our employees' addresses.
City agencies like the fire department have been passing names of neighborhoods and places that need the deliveries to the aid group. Manager Joe Spicer is happy to get the water, and after 10 years of living in Jackson, he's fallen for the city.
You know, it's a great place. We just got to kind of get the things together that we need to get together to make it somewhere where you can bring your family.
One of the things he'd like to see change is for the city to make more of an effort helping visually impaired people like himself. While there are free drive-through water sites across the city, he can't use any of them.
Because all the water distribution sites are set up for people that are sighted who can go to pick it up with their car. You know, it's frustrating, but it's been a battle for people that are visually impaired or people that can't get around for a long time.
And it's not just people who are visually impaired who can't make it to the water sites. Aisha Yanduro's charity, Springboard Opportunities, works with 5 affordable housing communities in Jackson.
A lot of the families here don't have access to transportation or access to childcare to actually go to the distribution centers. And so it really is about how do we just make sure that the needs within the communities that we work with are addressed.
But even beyond those issues, it takes a lot of gas to wait, in some cases, 2 hours at a distribution site. Yanduro says the family she's working with on average make about $12,000 a year.
Time costs, gas costs. So it's all of these pieces that so many of us take for granted that families are having to negotiate right now.
The state and National Guard have their own water distribution programs, while Jackson is relying on nonprofits for delivering water to homes, according to the Mississippi Rapid Response Coalition. The coalition says it's sending water Yanduro's way, though she's also been making her own calls to get water to her affordable housing complexes. She finally got hold of a sheriff in Alabama who drove down a trailer's load of water.
Hey, Sheriff.
How are you?
I'm so good.
65-year-old Yvette Day is one of the residents getting a couple of packs from today's delivery. She's thankful for the water, but all this waiting has really gotten to her.
I've been depressed because, you know, I have no one to help me to get the water. And I have no way to get the water, so I've been very depressed about it and about this situation here.
Jackson has dealt with boiled water notices for decades, so the nonprofits are used to home water deliveries. But those past notices were in just pockets of the city. The groups were not prepared for all of Jackson's water supply to be threatened. The Mississippi Rapid Response Coalition says it should be able to ramp up home deliveries this week. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Bisaha in Jackson, Mississippi.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine has decimated the tourism industry there, yet people are still determined to take a break. Coming up later today on All Things Considered, travel to the Carpathian Mountains, the wildly popular domestic getaway that continues to offer visitors the quiet of nature and stunning views despite the war. Listen by asking your smart speaker to play your member station by name. This is NPR News.
This is Morning Edition on WPR, and it's 8:42 now. Coming up, a new documentary follows the unique experiences of women videographers covering war. No Ordinary Life makes its television debut today. We'll hear about it in 9 minutes.
Meetings of the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin System and its committees that relate to this broadcast station are generally open to the public. Certain meetings or portions of meetings may be closed in order to address confidential information or proprietary matters. More information about specific meeting dates, times, and locations is available on the WPR website at wpr.org. Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, home to 1,500 undergraduate students from nearly every state and more than 50 countries. Dedicated to an engaging global education. Lawrence.edu.
Supporting WGTD is the Bristol Renaissance Fair, carrying you back to 16th century England with huge turkey legs, ale, wine, feasting, and nonstop entertainment on 13 stages and in the village streets. Open Saturdays and Sundays through Labor Day. Online at renfair.com.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and here's some of what's happening in the news. Zimbabwe's health ministry says the death toll from a measles outbreak has risen to almost 700 children. Some are calling for the enactment of legislation to make vaccination mandatory in a country where anti-modern medicine religious sects hold sway over large swaths of the population of 15 million people. The Southern African country country's health ministry said it had recorded 6,291 cases of measles as of yesterday. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis' efforts to place candidates fully aligned with his conservative views on school boards throughout the state is helping him expand his influence. Of the 30 candidates endorsed by DeSantis in the August 23rd elections, 19 won, 5 lost, and 6 are headed for runoffs. The endorsements highlight DeSantis' expanding sphere of influence as he runs for re-election as governor this year and considers a 2024 presidential bid. Stay with us. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio just after 9. And then it's classical music with Stephanie Elkins.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping companies, from nonprofits to the Fortune 500, find food for meetings and team lunches, tax-exempt ordering and delivery nationwide at EasyCater.com.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. There is a lot of money to be made from college sports. Just ask the Big Ten Conference. Last month, it announced an exclusive broadcast deal reportedly worth more than $7 billion. But as NPR's Andrew Limbong reports, none of it will be going directly into the players' pockets.
At a training camp press conference, Ohio State quarterback C.J. Stroud was asked by a reporter if a cut of the Big Ten broadcast deal should be going to the athletes.
I'll probably have to think about that a little more, but just off rip, I would say yes.
He goes on to give a more diplomatic answer, saying that, yeah, his tuition is covered, and he's grateful for that, but...
Me personally, my mom has always taught me to know my worth.
Jason Stahl is the head of the College Football Players Association, or CFBPA.
They're not even pretending anymore. It's about money. It's about creating the biggest deal you possibly can so you can get a lot of good press in the sports and entertainment industry.
The CFBPA isn't a union, but more like an advocacy and organizing group that's argued that athletes playing in this upper tier of college football should get a cut of the revenue. NPR reached out to the Big Ten for a response, but they didn't get back to us in time. Stahl says that in the past, the Big Ten would have argued that everything they do is in the service of educating the student athlete. But now, with this deal and over the summer adding two California schools to the conference, that pretense is gone.
Because the idea that a college athlete getting on a cross-continental flight to play a game is somehow in service of an academic agenda is obviously absurd.
There's been one recent change that's allowed college athletes access to a source of income. About a year ago, after a Supreme Court ruling, the NCAA changed their rules to allow student athletes to monetize off their name, image, and likeness. This means now college athletes are allowed to get endorsement deals and do commercials. But that's third-party money, not money coming from the team, school, or conference system.
I think that the money that they're making for the universities definitely outweigh the price of that college tuition.
Jordan Meacham is on the leadership committee of the CFBPA. He's also a former college football player himself, mostly playing at Sacred Heart University before moving to South Dakota State University. And he says that for him, getting paid would have meant that he didn't have to stress out about regular expenses, food, rent, books.
If I would have been able to receive some sort of compensation or some kind of help, I would have not focused on the other things as much and put more focus into academics and football and so on.
Victoria Jackson is a sports historian at Arizona State University. She says, historically, we as a culture understood the athletic scholarship as a fair trade for their efforts. But now?
These athletes play for schools that are bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars, conferences that are bringing in now billions of dollars, and an NCAA system in total that's bringing in close to $20 billion annually.
Football and basketball take up a lot of the conversation around college sports because they bring in the money, money that's used to subsidize other sports, which introduces a racial dynamic to this, says Jackson, considering the top-tier players in NCAA football and basketball are majority Black.
And the athletes who are being subsidized are often the privileged kids who play water polo or rowing or tennis or golf. and are less likely to be in need of having a scholarship experience as the reason they get to go to college.
She says she'd like to see the conferences writing this, but it might again come upon the Supreme Court to do something about it. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and we'll have the latest news from NPR and WPR at the top of the hour, and then classical music with Stephanie Elkins.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Honor a life well-lived with a gift of a service for burial or cremation with a professional, friendly, and compassionate staff. Serving the community for 90 years, Piasecki Funeral Home.
And take part in a community quilt project. WPR is pleased to support arts and crafts in our communities. Find out more at quiltshow.com.
In sports, the Brewers lost to Arizona yesterday 5-1. The Diamondbacks won 3 of 4. Milwaukee starts a 3-game series against the Colorado Rockies this afternoon. In the weather forecast, some patchy morning fog, then a mix of sun and clouds in the south, and sunny skies for the rest of the state, highs from the upper 60s to mid-70s. On Tuesday, partly sunny in the south, mostly sunny elsewhere in the region, and highs in the mid to upper 70s.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Before smartphones or social media, the only way to see images of war zones from around the world was through someone else's camera. In a new CNN documentary airing tonight, we meet five women who forged careers behind the video camera starting in the late 1980s.
It was literally walking through decades of history from the fall of the Berlin Wall, early Gulf War, Lebanon, Sarajevo, to the Arab Spring uprising. But the reason I did the film was because I didn't think that people actually knew that it was these women behind the camera.
That's Heather O'Neill. She's the director of the film, No Ordinary Life. It reveals how these brave women carved out careers in a male-dominated profession, all while on the front lines of war zones.
I had to be twice as good and twice as fast just to be on the equal playing ground as a guy. I had to work harder. I had to be better to be seen as an equal.
That's the voice of Jane Evans, one of the camera women profiled in the film. She's joined by Mary Rogers, Cindy Strand, Margaret Moth, and Maria Fleet. I asked Maria about the sexism she faced on the job.
Many times people would look at me and say, "That camera is bigger than you are." And it's a very aggressive business too, a very competitive business. So we had to prove ourselves in the field and make sure that the guys took us seriously.
There's a sort of duality in being among the first to do something, right? I mean, as women in this field, you and your female colleagues wanted to be treated equally to your male counterparts. But at the same time, the film points out that you brought something different to the work. What was that?
You know, as women, I think we have a particular different experience going through the world. And so that gives us a different perspective. We didn't focus as much on the hardware and the strategy, but what was happening to the people who, through no fault of their own, were displaced and uprooted by these conflicts. And we felt like that actually could maybe capture the viewer's attention more readily and help them understand what was happening in this conflict.
You and the other women in the film each kind of nod to the toll that this kind of work takes on anyone who does it. but these stories in particular, especially the coverage of the genocide in Rwanda, it is hard to imagine how difficult it was to shoot those images. How did you learn to compartmentalize that trauma? Because no doubt it had it. Now we call it that. Back when you were covering these stories, we didn't really talk about PTSD, especially not for journalists.
No, that's true. And you use the word compartmentalize, and that's exactly what you have to do when you're in the middle of something unfolding like that, that is really horrific. So you have a million things going through your mind. You're thinking about, where is this going? Where might I need to move? What might be happening around me that is unsafe? And, you know, I think it does take a toll later, because you know, those images, as visual people, those images float around in our brains afterwards. And it's nothing compared to the trauma that the people we've witnessed have gone through. But there is a residue of this information and these horrible images that rest with us.
With each new assignment came new risks. And while covering the Iraq War in 2003, Maria Fleet found herself in a situation that would change the rest of her life. A warning to listeners, you're about to hear the sound of gunshots. You recount one reporting trip to Iraq when the vehicle you were traveling in came under attack. Can you tell us about that moment and how it then changed how you assessed your own risk out in the field?
So we were coming down from the north and investigating Tikrit, which was Saddam Hussein's hometown, and it was thought that if he were to make a last stand, he would make a last stand there. And we deemed it safe enough to go into the town. But once we got in there, we were almost surrounded by a couple of pickup trucks with guys with AK-47s in the back.
We're gonna stop.
All right,
they're saying don't film.
And we decided to leave, but they chased us and shot into our cars.
Okay, that's gunfire. Okay, we've just come under attack. Under attack.
There were like 12 rounds that came into my car.
Go. Stop, so Will can catch up to us, please.
Coming.
One hit my flak jacket and thankfully shattered. And so I only got a scrape on my head.
So mom is bleeding, and I've got shrapnel in the head or something. Both of us are bleeding in the head.
But I mean, I really, at the moment that all of that was unfolding, I just thought, we made a mistake. We took a risk, but we miscalculated, and this is how it ends.
You ended up turning down your next assignment to Iraq, right?
I did. It was very unusual for me to turn down an assignment, but I had had two very, very close calls in Iraq. And I just thought, I am a little bit superstitious. And I just thought, no, I have to pass on this one.
I think it was Cindy Strand in the film who talks about the responsibility of filming people in their most vulnerable moments. And she says that she makes peace with that by promising herself to continue to do the work. Did that resonate with you?
Oh, absolutely. Because being in situations where you're often meeting them in the very, very worst moment of their lives, and you are covering the story for a couple of weeks, and then you go home to your nice and comfortable life, there's a certain guilt associated with that. Like, you feel like you want to do more, and why couldn't you do more? But I felt like my offering was my witnessing. I was the witness to what was happening for the world, and that gave me some peace. I felt like that was my offering to the people I was meeting.
Maria Fleet, former CNN camerawoman, she is one of five videographers featured in the new documentary, No Ordinary Life. It debuts tonight on CNN. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Melissa Ingalls. Thanks for listening to Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear the program weekdays from 5 to 9 a.m. We'll have news updates from NPR and WPR every hour, and there's always more news for you online at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from Door County North, welcoming visitors to Upper Door County, featuring cultural events, local artist studios with galleries, and Wisconsin's International Dark Sky Park. More is at DoorCountyNorth.org.
Support comes from the UW Parkside Foreign Film Series, welcoming patrons back to the cinema starting September 15th. Information about season subscriptions, which include 14 films and 3 guest passes, is at uwp.edu/Rita or at the Rita box office Monday through Friday, 12 to 4. You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR News.